This is an absolute pleasure for me this evening. I got to sit and listen to Katie and Charlie in 2009, and we formed a little group because the theme of the weekend was the eighth step and the word all. And we formed an amends group out of that weekend. And some of the stories that we heard and the sense of urgency that developed was embodied by both of them. And Charlie landed so deeply in me. And, you know, I listened to him often online and listened to his experience and his love for a man, Mark, who I just got to have a I just heard his voice on a phone call. He was on speakerphone with Scott way back in the day, and I was at Scott's house. And Mark Houston changed the course of my life. And I hear Mark and Charlie. And I hope all of you get heroes in this program. I've got to spend 4 weekends with Charlie over the years, and I've learned so much from this man. And I listen to him, and I try to sit in a contemplative manner with what he's talking about and try to put it in practical application so I can have my own experience with it. But it's a countless number of things that I've heard this man say over the years that have been hardwired into me. And I love him. I love listening to him. You guys are absolutely going to love him. And I give you Charlie.
That was beautiful.
Thank you, brother.
Wow. Am I on? Can y'all hear me? Yes. Let me start my little timer. This is, I don't care how long I talk, but this is to give you hope. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. Hey, sober since March 22nd of 1985, and I'm truly grateful for that. That puts me right in the middle of the pack this weekend. Katie's got, I guess, 5 months more than me, and then Mike's like 5 months behind me, but we're all, you know, well, Mike and I are class of 85, which is arguably the best class since the class of 35, it's really good to be here. It's a little bit of a daunting task, you know. I mean, on one side, it's like, what are you going to talk about when Katie and Lorenz have been up here all day, you know, talking about stuff? But then on the other hand, you're like, how do you foul that up? You know, I could get up here and juggle, and you guys would have had a great day. I got to tell you, I do want to thank Ben for picking us up and Tarek for putting all this on. And Ben has, you know, got a lot of grief from Katie, but that just means she loves you. This is not what I was expecting from a monastic environment. We've been to some other monasteries before, and while Brother Christopher's in here, I just want to tell you, man, this place has been fantastic, and we want to thank you for your. Yeah. I mean, it's all good, and good things happen, but when we were at the one in Conyers, I told Katie, I go, my God, I've been thrown into better places than this. I mean, it was, had this funky little twin bed, you know, and like, are we going to split that? You know, but I got 3 different sets of notes up here. I may not talk about any of them tonight, but I'm really looking forward to being with you folks. I've been having a lot of fun, and I'm with, you know, 2 of my heroes, Katie and Lorenz. Lorenz is my go-to 10-step buddy. I hope to talk about that at some point. I'll go ahead and get it out of the way now. There'll be times in my talk where I'll say we're going to get back to that later, and what that means is this ain't the appropriate time to bring in that little chunk of information right now. But when I tell you we're coming back to it, we're probably not coming back. You know? I always get real excited when I circle back around to one, but you know, I will be talking about some of the experiences I've had with Lorenz and certainly with Katie. You know, one thing you'll notice is that my talk and Katie's talk have a lot in common. Both of us talk a great deal about Katie. But, you know, I wear a coat and tie because I was trained that way. I just can't, I can't not do it. And when I was pretty new, you know, I've been sober 37. I've been sober 2 days, 6 months, and 37 years because I just had my little half a birthday on September 22nd. But when I was, I hadn't been sober that long, I was going to just introduce somebody or read how it works at a conference. I can't remember what it was, but my first, I had a temporary sponsor, Jim, for 17 years. And I was getting ready to introduce it, and he goes, "Charlie, it's okay if you don't want to wear a coat and tie when you get up there this weekend." I thought, oh, good. And he goes, "I mean, you still have to wear one, but it's but it's okay if you don't want to, you know, it's like, really, really not an important part of the deal, you know. I hope to talk a little bit about what I was like. And, you know, and having so much ground covered in advance, maybe I can get to some of the parts of the talk that I never get to before. But I'm borrowing Katie's fashion-conscious glasses tonight. But, you know, one of the things I like, I want my home group's the primary purpose group of Alcoholics Anonymous. In Austin, Texas, we meet on Tuesday nights at 2701 South Lamar. It's a line-by-line big book study meeting, and I don't have to say it to you guys, but a lot of times I say it's a lot more fun than it sounds like. We study the big book week after week, and we've been doing it for 16 years. And it's just super powerful. And before COVID, we had 225 to 275 people on a Tuesday night studying the big book in Austin. And I like to say that Alcoholics Anonymous is making a big comeback in AA, because there was a time when it was just all discussion meetings and that sort of thing, you know. But my sponsor is Myers. And some of you know Myers and his twin brother and Chris. And then before that, my sponsor was Mark Houston. Mark Houston was only in my life for about 4 or 5 years, 4 years. And I have to be careful how I describe that because, you know, one of the guys said, "So you're only working with Mark for 4 years?" And I was like, "Yeah, you know, a lot can happen in 4 years, though." And he's like, "Yeah." I go, "Like Jesus' ministry. Other than that, you know, I mean, you know, not much." I'm sorry. I can feel the room pucker up sometimes when I say that word. But Mark really changed my life. And Brandon picked me up when we came to do the one, and wearing a hot dog outfit. And he was dressed in civilian clothes this time, but. When we were in Georgia, I look up and here's this guy wearing a hot dog suit. And I was like, "This is going to be a fun weekend." But, you know, before we get going, there's a joke I like to tell to warm, if we're not warmed up already, but it just kind of warms the room up. And, you know, because I'm going to talk a little bit about what I was like, what happened, what it's like now. And for me, a lot of times it's what I was like, what happened, then what happened, and what it's like now. And I really hope to get around to talking about some of that. But, you know, we talk a whole lot in AA about coming out of our own experience. And there's a joke I like to tell around that. And some of you have heard this joke before. Some of you have heard me tell this joke before. But it's a good joke, and I like the way I tell it. So it's about this guy that's driving along one day on this little country road, and he passes this farmhouse, and there's a sign on the fence post, and it says, "Talking dog for sale." And he can't stand it. He goes up to the door, and this old farmer sitting there, and he goes, "So you got a talking dog?" And he goes, "Yeah, he's around back." And he goes around back, and this old red hound dog is laying there, and he looks at the dog, and he goes, "So you can talk?" And the dog says, "Well, I certainly can." And he goes, "My God, how did that happen?" He goes, "Well, it's actually a very interesting story." He said, "When I was young, I started picking up language skills from some of the humans that I interacted with. And as I got older, I started working with some of the nuances of the language. I started working with slang and colloquial phrases and some of that sort of thing." And he said, it's really made for a fabulous life for me. He said, "I had a 19-year career with the Drug Enforcement Administration. I was able to infiltrate some scenes that no human agent would have ever been able to get into." And he said, "But I've traveled the world. I've eaten the cooking of some of the greatest chefs. I've stayed in some of the finest hotels in the world." He says, "But really enough about me." He says, "More interesting than that," he says, "some of my pups have developed foreign language skills and have become international diplomats." He says, two of my pups are in the United Nations building right now as international diplomats." And the And I goes, my gosh, it's just been fascinating talking to you. And he goes back up front where that farmer's sitting there, and he goes, man, how much do you want for that dog? And the guy goes, I don't know, $40 maybe? Does that sound fair? And he goes, why on earth would you sell a fabulous dog like that for $40? And the farmer thinks for a minute, and he goes, none of that crap he told you is true. You know? It's kind of like that around here, you know. I mean, it doesn't matter how good the story is, because, you know, we can smell a line of bull from a mile away, you know. So that's why we talk so much about coming out of our experience. I'm gonna bust into my talk, and I'm really looking forward to skipping over a lot of the pieces where I spend a lot of time normally. But I come from Dallas. I live in Austin now. I've been in Austin since 1977. I went to Austin and drank my way out of the University of Texas in pretty short order, and I've been there ever since. And I went back in 81, and then I heard about treatment, and some of that stuff, you know, comes in later on. But I come from Dallas, and I grew up during the baby boom. I was born in 1956. It was the baby boom was in full swing. There were 61 children on the block that I grew up on, and 16 of them were the Messick family. They're passionate Catholics, but there was a lot of kids, you know. It was a baby boom, and a lot of stuff going on. It was a pretty good time in America. But then, you know, it got a little weird. As I got a little older. But I come from a pretty normal family. I mean, my father was a salesman, mostly forklift trucks, but he'd sold several things. And my mother was a first grade school teacher for 42 years. My sainted 99-year-old mother, who's still with us, still lives in a 3,600 square foot house by herself. She'll be 100 years old in February, and she loves Alcoholics Anonymous, let me tell you. But she's not as impressed with my sobriety date as I am. She's Southern Baptist, and she's like, shouldn't have been drinking to begin with, you know? My mother was a first grade school teacher, and I was really well prepared for the first grade. I mean, I kind of crushed it, really. I mean, because they were so much better parents than I ever was. I mean, it was spelling bees and flashcards and the stuff that I was way too self-obsessed to do with my kids, you know. And my mother had a way of moving just this one finger when she would talk to you. Not the wrist, not the arm, just this one finger. And she would go, you are such an idiot. You drink every day. I'll get around to talking about that hopefully a little bit in the first step. But I mean, you know, but you know, I had a sister. I still have a sister. It's funny, my mother's youngest child is 65 now. I mean, my sister's 71 and I'm 65. And my sister was a tough act to follow. She was kind of all everything. She was first chair flute player, National Honor Society, drum majorette, exceptionally beautiful and smart, and then there's me. And I mean, did anybody else grow up under the burden of potential by show anybody? I mean, that's all I heard about. Was my mother talked about IQ, and she talked about potential, you know, and she was obsessed with, you know, having a high IQ. And I thought that meant if they told you had a high IQ, I thought that meant you got a free pass and you never had to work, you know. And turns out it'll get you a front row seat in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It's about as much good as it. But my sister, and I used to hear a lot about, why can't you live up to your potential? You know, if you could just apply yourself. Did anybody hear that? You know, I still don't know how to do that. You know, but I mean, it was like, if you could, why can't you be more like Charles Mollier across the street? You know, and I remember thinking, well, Mom, that's really flattering. You know, but I'm really not holding back that much. You know, you're kind of getting my best shot at it, but. I'm glad you think I got this great untapped reserve, you know, but one of the things I remember is I was a lazy boy. Oh my God, I was lazy. In fact, it's funny how things will bring back memories. It's cool. This room has probably 10, 15 years younger in median age than a lot of the workshops we do, and it's awesome. But more of you will remember Napoleon Dynamite than some. And I remember watching Napoleon Dynamite, and there's a scene where he goes, "I don't feel like it," and it just flooded memories back for me, because I don't know how I got away with saying that. My dad was a big man. My dad was 6'3", 230 pounds. You know, his mother yard, like, "I don't feel like it." You know, and I don't know why they didn't just like go, "Well, somebody write that down. Charlie doesn't feel like it. Now get out there and mow the grass." But I mean, I'm just so, you know, so lazy. And my sister was, you know, hard to follow, but none of that stuff made me alcoholic. And I talk about being a grateful, recovered alcoholic, and I know in this room that's not offensive or outrageous. There's a lot of places where I don't lead with recovered alcoholic. If we're going to grow in understanding and effectiveness, like it talks about in the 10th step, sometimes I worry that if I come right out the gate with recovered alcoholic, I'm going to turn off my target audience. You know, the exact guys that I'm trying to get a message to are the ones that are going to go, "Oh, he's one of them." You know, he's got one of those big books. You know, and that sort of thing. But if we're talking about having recovered, what are we talking about recovering from? And I usually spend a lot of time on this. I'm going to try to get through it real fast tonight. But it turns out that as an alcoholic, I have two problems with alcohol. One happens to me when I drink it. The other one happens to me when I don't drink it. Other than that, I don't struggle with alcohol. That was big. I mean, you know, I've said that at the treatment center before, and they look at you and go, "When do we smoke?" You know. But I mean, you know, it talks about it, and it's, you know, it's funny. I gave a talk last Saturday in the UK on Zoom, and there was a woman there that had been in AA for a week, sober for a day, and at the end of the thing she said, what would you do, what do you recommend for somebody like me? It was in the conversation at the end of the meeting. I said, "You need to read the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, There Is a Solution, More About Alcoholism, and get a clear idea of what you're up against, you know, because this is not something that's gonna succumb to your will. This is not something where you decide to make up your mind." And so the book spends the doctor's opinion 44 pages talking about step one, because it drives everything. You know, my first job when I sit down with a new guy, I say new guy because I work with guys, but is to give them a fatal dose of alcoholism, or what I call a first step experience. And it goes like this. Basically, the first piece of it is what happens when I drink it, and the book calls it, it says, on Roman numeral 28, it says, "We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics," right? We're not talking about little part-time, you know, drinking. We're talking about chronic alcoholism. It says that the action of alcohol, and I started to say candy-ass disco drugs, but I didn't know if that was appropriate or not, But you know, it says the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy. And I like to break all that down, because this is not language that I use. Anything I talk about is stuff I've learned since I've been here. And the most important thing a guy can do with anything that I say or that you hear is lay it up against your own experience and see if it's a fit. Is this my condition? Is this what happens to me when I drink it? Because when I would drink, it would trigger this phenomenon of craving. Now, I never thought I'd triggered a phenomenon of craving. I just thought I changed my mind. You know, that we're going to go in and have a couple. Well, I changed my mind. You know, turns out two is a bad number, you know, and that sort of thing, you know, and on it goes. And it's a serious thing, you know, and because when they said, "Do you want to go have a couple of drinks?" I'm in it. Yes, I'd like to go have, I'm not going to do anything stupid. I'm not going to do like last time. We're just going to have a couple of drinks. You know, nod your head if you understand me. We're just going to have a couple of drinks. And now it says, manifestation, it just means an allergy is an abnormal physical reaction. Manifestation is how it shows up. And how my allergy to alcohol shows up is in this craving that it, and it's a big problem and the book talks a lot about it, you know, and it says, let me get Katie's glasses out here. It says, and man, Roman numeral 28 needs to be beat up in your book. It need, you know, it's like, highlighted. We work that page a lot, but then it says, never occurs in the average temperate drinker. It doesn't happen to my sister. My sister's not alcoholic, never is going to be alcoholic. And Dr. Silkworth says later on, he goes, any description of alcoholism that leaves out this physical factor is incomplete, because it was big news when he started talking about the physical response to alcohol. And then it goes on to say, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Any argument on that one? You know, I think it's a little understated. You know, I was like, I like banana pudding, you know, but clearly, I mean, but I loved the effect produced by alcohol. But, you know, first time, Mark used to say, I probably still love vodka more than most people that are out there drinking it today, you know, and we just read the part in the book the other day about how we're not alcohol haters, or you know, and we're not Carrie Nation out there busting up kegs with axes and stuff. You know, it's like Mark Houston used to say, this is in a monastic environment, slightly inappropriate, but he used to say, I don't think anybody should stop drinking, smoking, or screwing until they absolutely have to. And you know, it was the same with the alcohol. Well, it says that while I admit it's injurious, after a while I can't tell the truth from the false. Right, it feels like, because I don't go from the way I'm sitting in treatment thinking, when I get out of here, I'm going to buckle down, I'm going to tweak this deal a little better. I'm not as lame as these other guys, you know, but when I get out of here, I think I can, you know, get a handle on this deal, even though there's very little evidence to suggest that I'm fixing to get a handle on it, right? You know, but then it says, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I got a statistic I've been working with that I just love. This is going to blow your mind. As far as our alcoholic life seems to be only normal, check this out. Did you know that most people are born, live their whole lives, and die without ever being arrested? I know. It's crazy. I mean, you know, if I called my mother and said I can't come over, you know, and I got to go see my PO and give a UA because I got a DUI, she'd have no idea what I'm talking about, you know. And then around here, we're like, oh, man, that's, you know, who's your PO? You know, how much time you got? Well, but then it talks a lot about it. But then it says their alcoholic life seems, but then it says, and it switches over. Over on page 23, it switches to the second piece of alcoholism, where it says, all these observations, what observations? The observations we've been making about what happens when I drink wouldn't mean squat. It says would be academic and pointless, but it means it wouldn't mean anything what happens to me when I drink if I didn't take the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. And I didn't think about that for a long time, because I can't blame the first drink, that phenomenon of craving, on being loaded. I make that decision stone cold sober because of the second piece of alcoholism, and that's that I don't get okay when I stop drinking. When I stop drinking, my problems don't go away. In fact, it feels like somebody kind of cranked them up a little bit, you know, and after a week or two without a drink, things start to bug me a little bit, you know, and it says I get restless, you know, and I don't like the way my clothes are touching me, and then irritable. Now, irritable, it's funny, there's a boy in Alabama that I just love. I sponsored him for a long time, and he called me one time, and he goes, yeah. I said, how you doing? And he goes, well, got a little irritated at work today, and then I left, and I got, you know, the traffic was irritating the heck out of me. When I got home, my wife said something that irritated me, and I said, you know, I hear you talking a lot about being irritated. And he goes, yeah. And I said, you probably wouldn't like being described as irritable. And he goes, no, I wouldn't. You know, because when I'm irritated, it's y'all's fault. But when I'm irritable, it sounds like there's something wrong with me, you know. And one of the biggest movements we can take in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is moving a guy from my problems are coming at me to my problems are coming from me. And we're going to talk about that some in the third step, I hope. But But there's this. So what happens is I get so uncomfortable without a drink that the mental obsession gets on me, and I take the first drink. Now, believe me, I used to drink at a little place called the Spillway Pub in East Dallas, and a lovely place. And I promise you, I never once walked in there and leaned up at the bar and went, "Oh, Bobby, God Almighty, spiritual malady is on me today." You know, I had a beer on the way over here, and it has triggered a phenomenon of craving. I mean, nobody talk like that, you know. I mean, you know, but what happens is, the last thing I want to say about step one is I get caught in this terrible cycle of alcoholism where I drink, and when I drink, it triggers the phenomenon of craving. Now, I'm drinking, and after a while, it starts getting bad, and it starts getting really bad until eventually I have to stop or I get stopped. Now, I've stopped, and now things are better. I mean, you know, maybe it's okay. Maybe she's not leaving. Maybe they're not going to fire me. So I started thinking maybe I might be making a little bit too big of a deal out of this thing, you know. But after a while, and now I'm not drinking, I start getting a little restless, and I start getting a little irritable. And if you had a 1,000-foot camera on me, you'd be able to tell within a matter of days when he's about to twist off, you know. And what happens is the mental obsession gets on me, and it makes me powerless over the first drink. I take the first drink, and I trigger the phenomenon of craving, and now I'm off again on the drink. So I drink until I have to stop, and then I stop until I have to drink. And I drink until I have to stop, and I stop until I have to drink. And if you're caught in that terrible cycle, there's a bottom below the bottom, you know. I tell the guys I work with, don't ever say it can't get any worse. That just shows a lack of imagination, you know. Because you might look back in a couple of years and go, man, I wish I'd quit back in 2022 when things were, you know, still going okay. So that's what I was telling that girl. And I was doing a 10-step with Lorenz one time. And this is all over our book, where the book says, here's the problem. Do you admit it's objectionable? Oh, by the way, you can't do a darn thing about it on your own power. It's all over the book. It brings me awareness and being objectionable, and then lack of power. And, you know, and I called Lorenz about something one time. It was a big problem. I don't remember what it was, but we've done a lot of 10 steps. And I was talking to him, and he goes, "Charlie, I'm not sure what the answer is to your problem, but I don't think that it's more and better application of your will." And that just like drenches you when and that's what I was trying to tell that lady in England last Saturday. Is this is not something because Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people that I might as well go with it. You know, on page 24, it talks about losing the power of choice and control, and when I talk about the loss of choice and control, I talk about the pawn shops. I loved any other pawn shoppers here tonight? My man. Somehow I knew that was going to happen. But I loved the pawn shops. I loved most everything about it. The interest rates were a little tough. But I remember, you know, what I liked about it was the purity of it. You know, there was no shame in their game. You know, I don't ever remember a pawnbroker going, "Good God, man, weren't you just here this morning?" You know, or you know, "What are you going to do with this money?" Or you know, it was never like that. You take them the deer rifle, they give you the money. You take them the shotgun, they give you the money. And now, and the thing is, we had a plan, and we drunks make some good plans. We make plans that you could take over the university, and they'd look it over and go, "Pretty solid plan," you know. And our plans work right up till they quit working, you know. And my plan was that I had 90 days to get everything out of the pawn shop. And in 90 days, I could usually pull some kind of a scam or do some kind of a deal that would net enough money to get everything out of the pawn shop. And now I should tell you before I go any further, one complicating factor in this equation was that I didn't own very much stuff. So I was having to pawn things that didn't belong to me. And it's you know, it's complicating, but it's not insurmountable. You know, it's because because I had a plan, and we're gonna go get it anyway, you know. So one day I pulled an little insurance scam, and I never talk about what it is because it would probably still work today, but I netted enough money to get everything out of the pawn shop, but it was also very important to go by the Spillway Pub and settle my little tab. I had a $60 tab. This is 1983. You could do a lot of drinking for 60 bucks back then, and it was the only place in Dallas that would let me run a tab, so it was important to go settle my tab, and then we're going to go get everything out of the pawn shop. That's it. You know, we're not going to do anything crazy, but I am a blackout drinker. In fact, I love this book. There are very few lines in this book that don't apply to me, but one of them is where it says, our stories are filled with countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like normal men. I don't have any experience with that. I was a blackout drinker. I was about oblivion from the very beginning, that's not everybody's story. I'd like to tell you that I drank a fifth of whiskey every day from the time I was 16, 13, till I was got to you people at 28. That wouldn't be true. But what I can tell you, and this isn't everybody's story in AA, but it's mine, is that I never one time turned down the opportunity to get loaded under any circumstances for any reason. I have no memory of ever saying, what's that? Oh, no. No, it's my mother's birthday or something like that. It was just, we'll work it out. We'll work it out later. And, and it's funny, I don't know why I'm saying this, but that's one of the things that tickles me with some of the treatment center talk, because he said we're not doing singleness of purpose, but I covered a lot of ground. But one of the things that tickles me, you hear stuff coming out of treatment that you didn't talk about on the street, and one of the ones that tickles me is when they talk about your drug of choice, right? That just tickles the heck out of me, because like I was ever really going to be somewhere, and you'd pull something out, and I go, what do you have there? Oh, no. that's not my particular drug of choice, you boys go ahead, I'll just wait over here for my DOC to appear. I don't know, maybe that was somebody's story, but it wasn't mine, but on this day I'm gonna get everything out of the pawn shop, and next thing I know I came out of a 5-day blackout. Now I had a lot of those overnight blackouts, those blackouts where you don't remember the drive home, or you have to look out the curtains to see if the car's in the driveway, or I don't remember exactly how we got here, but this was 5 days, solid blackout, and I only remember one thing from that whole 5 days, and that was when my companion that I was running with got cut at a party we were at. Apparently we were rude, but he got cut, I didn't. But that's the only thing I remember out of 5 days. And I come out of this blackout, and I'm sitting upstairs on the edge of the bed at my mother's house. I should tell you that I was so poorly treated as a child that I ran away from home for good at the age of 28. I'm serious. Never went back. That's not Katie's favorite part of my story, but she's had some talks with my mother I wish she hadn't had, I come out of this blackout, and I'm sitting on the edge of the bed at my mother's house, and in my right pocket I had $8, and in this left-hand pocket I still had all those pawn tickets, big old gangster wad of pawn tickets. And we've all had those mornings where you're just going, oh, no. Oh, no. I can still tell you exactly what the room looked like, the color of the carpet, the wallpaper, the furniture, the temperature of the room, because I was like, oh no, because now I got nothing, and I'm out of tricks, and I got nothing, and I got nothing, and it's time, it's go time, and I got nothing. And I shot my wad on that other scam, and my dad was a good man. My dad, nobody was giving him his stuff. He was working for his stuff. And here's his little dope fiend son out there pawning all of his stuff. And, but I'm not a sociopath. I had to look into it a little bit. I was worried there. I was worried there for a minute. But I'm not a sociopath. And I wasn't gonna let my dad's shotgun go for $40, you know. And so I would have to. But I didn't have a lot of options. So I would have to go to my father, and he was a good man, and go, "Dad, listen. If we act now, I can get you a pretty good deal on all your stuff. You know? But if we wait till tomorrow, it's strictly retail, you know." And I mean, are there any Al-Anons in the room? Pure Al-Anons? Okay, yeah. I mean, yeah, we talked to her. Believe me, we know that ain't funny. You know, I have to tell that like it's a joke, because if I touch the desperation of that morning of having to go and tell my father that my best tools, all of his stuff was in the pawn shop, I'll cry like a little girl in a pink dress up here, you know. And the thing was, we would have to get in his car, and Dallas is a big spread out town. It's like Los Angeles. It's not just go to the pawn shop. It's we got to go up on East Grand and get your deer rifle. We got to go down on Buckner Boulevard and get your shotgun, and your sterling silver's over in Oak Cliff, and the metal detectors are out on Garland Road. So it was all day. It's funny, one of my sponsors was up in Dallas. He goes, "I feel like I'm driving through your story. I see all these signs, you know." But it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. And when we'd be driving around, I'd be going, "Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again. I don't want to feel like this. I don't want you to feel like this. I swear to God, I will never do this again." And if I was lying, I darn sure didn't know it, because it felt like I meant it with everything that I had. But what I didn't know, riding in his Dodge pickup truck with him, was that I didn't have the power to make good on that promise. That's what I'm talking about with powerlessness in the first step, is do you have the power to manage the decision? Do you have the power to stop drinking when you really want to? And for unmanageability, all I cover in one. Now, when we get to two and three, we go broader scope on the unmanageability. But in one, I'm like, can you or can you not manage the decision to stop drinking when you really, really want to? Just like it says on page 44. Because I would hit the back door of my dad's house like a cat burglar, and within 3 days, it'd just be like, that, you know, and off we'd go. And by the time I got to you people, my father and I had made the rounds of the pawn shops 3 times. That's how many times, that's how slick I was, that's how cool I was. I was a burden to anyone that was unfortunate enough to love me or be associated with me. And that's the guy I brought to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I say I was powerless, it was an ugly situation. That's why my mother loves Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want to move into a little bit about what happened, then what happened, because, I came to AA. Let me turn the page here. Believe me, some people don't need notes. I do. I'm back. Let's get back to my drinking. It started going downhill. And you know, because there for a while, if drinking would still do for me what it did for me when I was 16, 17, 18, you'd have a different speaker up here tonight, you know. But it got real ugly, and it stayed ugly for a long time. And I started having more trouble, and I started having criminal charges, and started wrecking cars. I wrecked every car my mother owned except for this one silver Civic that took me years to remember. There, I was like, the Civic. I never wrecked the Civic, you know. And Katie's like, "What a good boy you are." You know? I mean, but I wrecked all these cars. And one time I left a bar in a blackout and smashed into another car. I'd had 5 Long Island teas at this pub. Turns out that's at least one too many. And I smashed into this car. I could barely see it. You know, you remember when your field of vision would get real small? And I could see a fender at an odd angle over here, but I kept my foot on the gas, and I go around the corner, and I grab my shoes. I don't know why my shoes were off, but they were in the passenger floorboard. And I grab my shoes, and I go running back to this bar to report the car stolen. And now this is not an extraordinary night either. This is just kind of a day in the life of Charlie Parker at this time, you know. But I'm going to go back to the bar. I've got my shoes in my hand, and I'm running along the road, and I see these cops. I'm running under these trees, and I see these cops, and they got those big old flashlights, and they're shining, and there's glass everywhere on the street, and they're shining, and it's kind of beautiful, really. I mean, all these twinkling lights. But I'm running along under the trees, and I'm thinking, my God, they got here fast, you know. And I run back to the bar, and the next morning they call, and they said, Mr. Parker, you're going to have to take a polygraph test to get your car back. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, it was involved in an accident before it was reported stolen. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And he goes, no, they actually ran into a parked police car. I remember thinking, that explains how they got there so fast. You know, because I'd been really foggy on that one. But, you know, Norm Alpe was one of our speakers way back, and he used to talk about seconds and inches. He used to talk about that our lives were saved and changed by seconds and inches. And there were so many, if those cops had been standing there that night, there were so many things where I got, you know, little breaks, where things could have gone so much worse. But I mean, so about this time I go back down to Austin, and I hear about treatment. The maintenance man in my apartment would come in. We're sitting there taking bong hits, getting ready for school, and this maintenance man kept talking about, I never get to say bong hits in my talk. That was, yeah. I mean, but I don't know why he thought we wanted to hear about it, but he kept talking about treatment. His wife had gone to treatment, and one of the things he said that was really, he gave one of the bad pieces of advice he gave me was, he said, You might want to go pull a really good drunk before you go to treatment, because they're going to make you not want to drink anymore. And I was like, I'm on it, you know. And that drunk took 9 months, and that whole 9 months I was fixing to go to treatment. You know, anybody else? You know, and next week's a pretty good time to go to treatment. You know, and sometimes when it was getting really bad, by God, I'm going to go tomorrow. You know. But tomorrow would get here, and it would always be today, and today never felt like the day, you know, to go, until it was that day, you know. And then one day, I went, to move forward in the, I think, 2.5 hours we have left, just checking, but I met this guy, Jim, and we worked the steps to the best of our ability. I thought I was a big book guy. My home group was a Tuesday night big book study meeting, and we thought, you know, we worked the steps. But you know, when we say, how do you know what you don't know, how could I possibly have known what I was missing? You know, I thought I was doing AA, and, you know, and that's my message, because I think for the bulk of AA society, when they talk about going back to AA, it means stopping drinking and going back to those meetings. You know, like AA is a place. You know, and we used to be a recovery program with a support fellowship, and over the years somehow we've kind of turned into a sobriety fellowship with an optional program. You know, and if you really need to work steps, you might want to go to those primary purpose guys or something. You know, but I mean, I came to I was going to the meetings. There was some God in my life. I struggled with the idea of a higher power because I'd left the Baptist church when I was 13, and I was operating on the understanding of a 13-year-old for my whole adult life. You know, and it's kind of funny. Katie talked about that one time. She was going, if you were going to seek a spiritual path, would you go over to the junior high school, you know, and go, hey, buddy, tell me your thoughts about God, you know? I mean, it's, you know, or do you talk to Brother Christopher? You know, it's like, I don't know. You know, but I mean, I had a lot of prejudice, and I had a lot of ideas about what I didn't believe in. And I couldn't tell you so much what I believed in, but I could spend a lot of time telling you what I don't believe in. You know, and I think that's why Abby Thatcher said, just pick something that you can believe in. But I'm working the steps, and my old approach to the steps was basically, are you an alcoholic? I figure I must be, because I didn't know anybody that had drank more than I did. I've met some since then. I mean, we got some impressive stories in here. I mean, this is the only fellowship where a guy can get up here and go, yeah, I, you know, burnt the Christmas tree down and burned it out of the driveway, and got a DUI and blew a 4.1 blood alcohol level, and we'll lean over to each other and go, 4.1, that's pretty solid. You know, I mean, but I mean, I figure I must be alcoholic. We didn't spend any time talking about physical allergy, mental obsession, terrible cycle, any of that stuff. And then, do you believe in God? Well, we had to dance around that. My experience has been, the harder you pound the step one experience, the less time you have to spend arguing about God. And on 27, it says, they, our founders, we, you know, in the book, when it says we, most of the time it's talking about our founders. The book is written from their perspective. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So most of the time when it says we, it's them saying this is what they did. We learned, we saw, we, you know, they said, we in our turn sought the same escape with the desperation of a drowning man. That's the power of a step one experience, because the cool thing about working with drowning men is they don't ask a lot of questions. You know, I mean, you know, if I'm drowning, I'm not going to go, pardon me. Before we proceed, how much experience do you have with drowning men? You know, and do you have any other life jackets? I'm not fond of this red one. All you're going to hear out of me is, help me. What do you want me to do? And the next thing you're going to, if I've had that step one experience, and the next thing you're going to hear out of me is, this always chokes me up. The next thing you're going to hear out of me is, I did that. Now what do you want me to do? And that's when we roll. But if we don't, if we breeze past that step one experience, if my step one is just kind of a mental exercise, then my step three is going to be an academic exercise. But because I don't know why I would give a flip about a power greater than myself if I still think my power is going to get the job done. But when I have that crushing step one experience, I'm willing to be real flexible about a step one experience. So I come to AA, I'm totally down, I do an inventory, I did a nice fifth step, 6 and 7, whatever, and then I made some amends, but I was amazed before I was halfway through. And you know, that list has a way of making its way into the drawer, and now I'm out and I'm working and you know, things are going better. You know, when physical, like Katie says, physical sobriety starts to look like recovery, because my life gets a lot better when I'm not drinking. And all of a sudden, I got a house, and I got a truck, and I get married, and I blew that marriage up. And, you know, and after a little while, I mean, and so at about 2.5 years, I get married, and about 40. Now, Katie is my best friend. We're home group members. She's watching all this stuff, and she's like my kid sister. So I didn't foresee that we might ever be a couple, because I gave her a 20-year free look at me, and there was stuff I would have concealed if I knew, because she's seen all these relationships and stuff. And so I get married, and in pretty short order, I've blown that marriage up. So I waited the appropriate amount of time to get into another relationship, right? 16 days. And 16 days, I'm back in another relationship, and Katie's not approving of this one either. And now, a little while later, I got another baby on the ground and another child support check going out the door, and I'm not living according to the values I grew up with, and things are happening, and I can't figure out why is this all blowing up in my face. And so then about that time, I get into this, I'm almost always in collision, but about 7 years, I thought, you know what, forget it. I've tried doing it your way. I forget rigorous honesty. And I kind of pulled back a little bit and went into what I used to call a flat period in recovery. What it was untreated alcoholism. And I thought I'd run up against the limits of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got married. I got into a relationship that was really dishonest. And the most dishonest thing about that marriage was me. You know, she did not get what she thought she was getting in that marriage. And I don't know how much to talk about, but let's just say there were millions of reasons to be in that marriage, if you get my drift. And Katie's disgusted, you know. At one, I never talk about this, but at one point Katie goes, and she lives in Austin, I don't think you're dating her. And if she lives in Austin and makes $35,000 a year, I guarantee you you're not dating her. And I'm like, so? You know, I mean, if she doesn't, if she lives in New York City, She makes a stack, you know. So what's your point? And that's, you know, so Katie's watching all this going. Well, so about that time, we had built a house out on Eastern Long Island. We had the apartment. To my mother, this was the ultimate relationship. She was a Wall Street investment banker and a big shot, and we got a house in the Hamptons, and Katie's just like, and we're traveling all over the world. I'm calling Katie from the south of France and the Isle of Crete, and you know, and all I can talk about is me. So one night we're out in the Hamptons, and I had some people out, and we chartered a plane to fly back into the city. We're gonna fly into LaGuardia. We're gonna go out to Cipriani's for dinner. And we're flying along, and it's the first time in my life I've ever chartered a plane. And we're flying over Long Island, and we're looking down at stuff, and it's 9:30 at night, and all of a sudden we're in a glider, and I'm in the co-pilot seat. Six-seater, people like to hear this. It was a six-seater Cessna 210 with retractable landing gear. And I'm in the co-pilot seat. I'm not a co-pilot. And I put on the headphones. And the thing you don't want your little charter pilot to be saying when you put on the headphones is he's going, come on, come on, come on, come on, man, come on. And he's jacking this little throttle switch on the dashboard. And they come on the radio and they say, you're cleared to Gabreski. And there's an airport right at 10 o'clock. We're not going to make it. We're not going to clear the water. We're not going to clear the trees. And we're darn sure not going to make this runway. And he says, you don't understand. I've lost engine power. I can't make land. I'm going to have to ditch. I'm a gambler my whole life, right? What are the odds the first time I ever charter a plane, we're going to crash into the water at night? And he turns towards the shore and he says, brace for impact. And we come in and I'm like, how? And he says, put your hands on the dashboard. So I put my hands on the dashboard and we come in and boosh. And we hit the water and it's like splashed down at Six Flags times 1,000. And there's noise and spray and water. And the cowling comes off, the windshield comes in, and all this noise and spray, and then absolute silence. And I'm like, I think we're okay, you know? I mean, because about that time, I felt something on my knee. And this wasn't much of an airplane, really crummy boat, you know? And about that time, water goes, and I can't get my seatbelt. I mean, I get my seatbelt off, but the door won't open. And the last thing my buddies hear me saying is, well, I can't get my door open. And I go underwater. And I go up to get air, and there's nothing but water in the roof of the plane. And that's when I remember thinking, so that's it. We die in this flipping airplane today. You know, and spoiler alert. Yeah, I didn't die, but I go back underwater and the door comes open and I get out and then I go back in and I get my wife out and then I go wife at the time and then I go down and there were five adults and a dog, and we had a little Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, and the only non-survivor was the dog. The dog drowned. We got him breathing again, and it's tragic, but we got another dog. You know. And so we go to the hospital. We go to the hospital, and then we go back to the house, the beach house, and I'm watching CNN, and this is back when CNN was like all the news, and there was a little thing going across the bottom. It says Hampton plane crash, five survivors, and I'm looking at it, and I'm going, I can't believe I was just in a plane crash. I mean, I'm scrambling eggs, and. And they're talking about it, and they call, and CNN had this reporter that was doing a little show. He was just a little cub reporter that was trying to make a name for himself, and he had a show called Live from the Headlines with Anderson Cooper. And I mean, he was nobody. And they sent a car for us, and so my friends around the country are going, is that Charlie? You know, and so, we're doing okay on time, yeah. So it changed everything for me, you know, and you know, because, I mean, there's no Earl Hightower story, but anybody know Earl Hightower? I was giving a talk with him out in Arizona one time, and he was speaking after me, and I told my plane crash story, and I came so close to going, now guys, be generous with our next speaker, because a lot of times when I tell my plane crash story, people want to try to make up their own plane crash story. His was a little more dramatic than mine, but it woke me up, and it turned out to be the beginning of a spiritual awakening for me, and I didn't see it coming, and so this big shift happened, because now there was stuff that I was fixing to get, like I was fixing to get out of that marriage for a long time, and the way, I mean, you got no spiritual giant up here. I'm better than I was then, but I mean, there would be times where I think I'm this is it. I'm going to say something this weekend, and I'd fly up there on a Thursday. You don't want to say it on Thursday. You know, you're going to blow up the whole weekend, and then the next, you know, it's Saturday. You go, oh, forget it. I'll just go home. You know, and because in 12 years, the longest we were ever together was 16 days. It was a commuting marriage the whole time, and so well on this day. I said, you know, that's it. I can't do this anymore. And I got out of that marriage, and I come back to Austin, and there was a guy, and I want to talk a little bit about my second approach to the work, because first of all, it was John Henry. And I come back to Austin, and I call up John Henry, this old timer in Austin, and I go, John Henry, brother, I am so self-obsessed. I can't even be in a conversation. This probably doesn't happen in Alabama, but I was like, I am so self-obsessed. I can't even be in a conversation with anybody. You know, I just have to force myself. You know, I go, hey, Frank, how are the kids? You know, and act like I give a flip about the answer, because I don't. I'm me and me and me, and I didn't even realize it was mentioned in the book. You know, but I come back, and John Henry takes me out, and we start carrying the messages. He says, why don't you meet me Wednesday? We'll go out. He liked to call them winos. He goes, we'll go talk to the winos on Wednesday. And you know, it's funny, when you're in trouble, service work never sounds like the right idea, you know? It's like, no, can we just meet somewhere and talk about me, you know? But I mean, we start going out there, and we're doing the steps with these guys, and there were times where I felt like I was a step ahead of these guys. Now, I got 17 years sober at the time, and there were times where I'd say, go read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, and I'd go home and read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. And you know, the ego can be put to work for good cause, you know, because in sponsorship, it's got to be okay to say, I don't know. You know, I don't know the answer to that. Let me go look it up. Let me give up my sponsor. But I'm trying to stay one step ahead of these guys, and things start happening. And about that time, I had 12-stepped one of my best friends into La Hacienda Treatment Center, where this guy with an eye patch worked. And Tom was taking 125 Vicodin a day. And apparently that's too many. But we 12-step him into this treatment center, and he meets Chris, and then he meets Myers, and then we come back, and I start going up talking to Myers, and I'm having a big experience. And Katie talked about it last night, and you know, there were times when she was like, oh boy, you know, but then about that time, this guy from Dallas calls, and you know, Tom and I are having these hour-long conversations in the morning about, you know, what do you do when they say this? Well, that's when I'll go to this page and I'll say that. What about this? Well, that's when I'll do that. Have you ever heard of the bedevilments? No, what are they? Well, they're on page 52, And we're having these, our conversations are changing, and a lot of our conversations are about how you sponsor guys and how you do the steps and that sort of thing. And about that time, this guy calls from Dallas, and he says, hey, he calls a guy in Austin, says, I heard about a big book study in Dallas. And I said, I know people in Dallas. Let me see. And I called up a friend of mine. He sends me this flyer, and it says, Big Book Experience with Mark H. and this other guy. I don't want to say who the other guy was, because he just bugged the crap out of me. Because the whole weekend, Mark would be talking, and I just felt like this silver cord of connection between us. And then the other guy would talk over him, and I'm like, I wish you'd shut up and let him keep talking, you know. But we go to this whole weekend, and I mean, like Katie said, we might not have driven across town for a Big Book meeting. We drive 230 miles to go to a Big Book weekend, and And the amazing thing about it, when you talk about, there's a thing on page 100. I used to close talks with it where it says, when we look back, we see that the things which came to us when we placed ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have imagined. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you'll presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. And I read that a long time before I saw where it says, when we look back, we seek. I can't see God's will happening right here today, but I look back sometimes and I see the undeniable hand of God moving in my life. Because one time after that weekend and everything that followed it up, I was going to get a massage and I told the guy, I said, would you mind if we listen to some AA CDs? And he goes, oh my God, you have no idea how sick of waterfall music I am. You know, I am. So we plug in Mark Houston from that workshop. And at the beginning, Mark went silent one time, and I'd heard about that. He went silent for 3 years because he felt like he was starting to buy some of his own press and had personal stuff going on. He didn't talk anywhere for 3 years. Well, he starts this talk off the first CD of that weekend. He says, well, this ought to be interesting because I haven't done anything like this in 3 years. And it just crushed me because I'm thinking, look at God move. I mean, here's Katie and Charlie in big trouble down here in Austin. He picks us up. He brings Mark out of a three-year silence, thrusts us together in an environment like this for a weekend, and it blew my mind. I mean, the whole weekend was unbelievable. Well, after that, we have a different approach to the steps. And the biggest mistake I see being made in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is moving from, are you alcoholic? Do you believe in God? Then let's get you right down on your knees and do the third step prayer. And that was my experience for the first period of sobriety. And if you do that, you skip this body of work from pages 60 to 63. And it's really not very important. It's just the root of my problem and the basis of my recovery for the rest of my life. And that's how I wound up working a program like The Problem Was Alcohol, because there's a line on page 60 where I was reading it one day, 17 years sober, and it says the first requirement is that Charlie be convinced that Charlie's life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And not only was I convinced of that, that line had never touched me, because we went right from do you believe in God to third step prayer. And it's all over the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it, this self piece, it's all we talk about. I mean, now I think my sponsees are going, oh no, I got a sponsor that's only read 3 pages out of the big book, you know, because all we talk about is 60 to 63, 84 to 88. But this self piece and the way that it's the, up on 62 is what I call the pivot point in Alcoholics Anonymous. I may run over just a little bit, am I good? It says, on top of 63, it says, it talks about that archway, the deal we make in step 3, I call this the deal, and it says, hereafter in this drama life, God's going to be our director. He's the principal. We are his agents. He's the father. We are his children. And then it goes on. Now, here's the pivot point in Alcoholics Anonymous, because everything in the book up to this leads to this point, and everything from here forward refers back to this point. And it's right here at the top of 63, and it's what I call the terms of the deal. We talked about how God doesn't make too hard terms for those that seek him. Here's the terms. It says, when we sincerely took such a position, what position? That God's in charge, and that suits me just fine. It says, when we took that position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. We had a new employer. Now, here's his part. It says, being all-powerful, he provides what we need under two circumstances. If I stay close to him and perform his work well. My part is stay close to him, perform his work well. His part is he'll provide what I need. And all I can tell you is when I go all in on that deal, God does a really good job of holding up his end of the bargain. But what I didn't see, there, from here on out, there ain't nothing else. Everything we do from here on out is about one of those two things. It's either about staying close to him or performing his work well. because I can't stay close to this power till I get close to this power, and I can't get close to this power when I'm blocked. So 4 through 9 is about removing what's blocking me from this power, which I've said in step 3 is my only shot. And then 10, 11 is all about staying close to this power and then carrying the message and practicing these principles in all our affairs. It changed everything for us. And I mean, you know, now it's all we talk about. And I started working the steps with these guys. I started forming it. We started primary purpose group. We started having my guys over at the house. And when you start talking solution in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, people come up and they want your phone number. You know, I used to do a little test for untreated alcoholism. And one of the tests was, you know, if you share in every meeting you go to and nobody ever asks for your phone number, might be an untreated alcoholism, you know. but you know, it just changed everything, because it turns out alcohol never was my problem. Alcohol was the only thing I'd ever found that would ease the discomfort of a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness. And it just changed everything. So now we're working with guys, reading 2 pages a day out of the big book, working with the set-aside prayer. We're turning statements into questions. We're establishing spiritual consent with each other and path of consideration, making all the amends like we were talking about. And it's just been unbelievable. I wish we had more time to talk about some of the ways that self manifests, because I love talking about story stealing. Well, Katie talked about it, but in my family, it's 3 words. I mean, you know, Katie was trying to tell a heavy story one night about her family, and she goes, well, it was in Baltimore. And my sister goes, I don't think I've ever been to Baltimore. And I'm like, you know. And it's like, you know, and that's what story stealing is. That's what you start a story. This will be fun to watch in the rooms. Story stealing is where you start a story and your story reminds me of one of my stories, and my story is way more interesting. So I come over the top of your story with my story, and you never get to tell your story. So we're continuing to do inventory, multiple 5 steps like Mike was talking about, making all those amends. And in 10 and 11, it really became a real piece of business. But I want to talk a little bit about 6 and 7, because this is important. Katie was going to give a talk one time on 6 and 7, and we had like 9 months to prepare for it. And think about it, if they said, hey, we'd like for you to speak at the Woodstock, you know, next spring, and you're like, oh, that'd be a real honor. And they go, we'd like for you to do an hour on step 6 and 7. Do? I mean, am I the only one that would run out of bullets after about 5 minutes, you know? And so we started really looking into 6 and 7, and what it turned into after my study, 6 and 7 are about 4 things. Is this objectionable to me? Whatever it is, I've never had to work real hard at finding things to work on in sobriety. Things seem to come at me plenty fast enough, you know? And something that wasn't even really a problem starts showing up on the horizon, and the next thing you go, it's, you know, it's a problem. And the book constantly is saying, here's this problem. The second piece, you know, the first piece of it, do you find it objectionable? Is it objectionable to you, or is it powerfully objectionable enough to the people you love that you need to make it a piece of business? If it is objectionable, the second piece is, do I have the power to change it on my own? And if I can't, if it's objectionable and I don't have the power to change it on my own, the third piece of it is, am I willing to let God change it in whatever way he sees fit? And if those 3 things are in place, I take it to God in the 7-step prayer, and I say, my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Well, it comes up all the time. And I want to, Katie has alluded to it. I'm going to close with this a little bit. About a year ago, I grew up in Dallas, and the State Fair of Texas is a big deal to me. You guys probably know that the corn dog was invented at the State Fair of Texas by Neil and Carl Fletcher in 1942. And it's like every corn dog you've ever had is on a level about like this, and boom, here's the Fletcher's corn dog. So we're up for the Dallas Cowboys game, and And we got ridiculous Cowboys season tickets. And we're up there for a Monday night football game. And I go, Katie, the fair's in town. Why don't we go push mom around the fair? We'll get a corn dog and we'll walk around and then we'll bring her home and go to the game. And she doesn't want to go, but I talk her into it. And we're at the fair and we're walking around and we're in this building and we're looking at stuff and she's talking to my mom. And I look at where this guy's got a booth, and all around it is Dallas Cowboys stuff. He's got a life-size Jason Witten thing and stuff on there. And I start talking to him about the Cowboys, and then I go, what are you doing? And he says, we're a company called Advanced Body Scan, and we do preemptive health care screenings and CT scans and MRIs. And Katie perks up, and she says, I want to do this. And so she sizes up, and I walk into a double-barreled sales pitch like you've never seen before. They're like, well, we got this package for $30,000, and we got this package for $14,000. Or if you don't really love your family, you could buy this $7,000 package. And so anyway, 2 hours go by, and we love the guy, and we sign up. And so this is 3 weeks after the fair. We're at their hospital. And so we go down to get the first CT scan, and this was last October or November, right in there. And we get the CT scan, and 2 days later, they call me on my 65th birthday, and they said, Mr. Parker, you have a sizable mass in your liver. I said, what? And he goes, it's 15 centimeters. I'm like, my God, I mean, that's like that big. And so we go and we meet the surgeon and he says, I think I can cure it. And they took out 60% of my liver in January. And it was a big surgery, but Katie was amazing for the whole process. She's sleeping in the hospital room with me and everything. And she's somebody you want on your side in a situation like that. But they're talking about cancer-free, and they're talking about we got it all, and we got complete containment. And so for about 5 months, we had this amazing, I was saying, you know, it was Cowboys, corn dogs, and Katie that saved my life. And then 2 months ago, 3 months, they called up and they said, need to get you back in for another scan. And they said, you got some new tumors in your liver. And so that's the reality we're faced with today. And so I've got radiated pellets in my liver now. They can't do the other surgery that they did before, but they're thinking they can treat it with these radiated pellets and then maybe do some immunotherapy. And then hopefully my friendliest path is if I can get a liver transplant. That's my best chance of long-term survival. Otherwise, they're talking about buying as much time as possible and, you know, for you to be with your family and conversations that I'm not enjoying being confronted with. But when we talk about 6 and 7, I wish you had a better, I'm a good example of a bad example, because the thing I can tell you is that the day they started of this diagnosis, and they're talking about the potential fatal condition of this thing, I hopped off the treadmill, haven't been back, you know, haven't worked, and started eating like a jackass ever since then. You know, and Mark used to talk about building character rather than seeking comfort. Well, I've been seeking comfort like a big dog for about 6 weeks, because this was, now there's been other things I've come across where I go, God, this is not going to interfere with our relationship, and I'd go straight to God. I didn't do that with this one. This one was so big and so overwhelming, I started just going to work, and give me the ice cream, give me the drive-through windows, and I put on about 17 pounds since then. And I had to go to one of my sponsees the other day, and I was like, Chad, I'm not really doing the deal right now. You know, I've fallen off on my meditation a little bit. I'm not doing the daily check-ins as much, and I'm overeating every day. And I got guys that I sponsor that love me with all that. If I get a transplant, it's going to be a living donor transplant. And I've had like 35 people. You talk about love that we find in these rooms. I've had like 35 people go, Charlie, if you need liver, I got you. You know, I mean, and it's just been so moving to have those kind of conversations. But Chad is, at one point, Chad leaned over to Katie and he goes, if anybody's giving Charlie liver, it's going to be me. You know, because that's my boy. I love him like a son. But we also have spiritual consent with each other. And there's been times where he's had to come to me, you know, because we have this license under spiritual consent. And he says, Charlie, you got to take it to God in 6 and 7 and make this, because what happens when there's something about when I get down on my knees and make a covenant agreement with God that we're going to, I need your help, because there's a big difference between I need to knuckle down and get a handle on this and going to God in complete surrender and saying, I'm weak and I screw up a lot and I'm holding power. It's about as good as it's going to get. If you don't help me, I'm in big trouble. And when you go to God in 6 and 7 with that kind of a surrender, it becomes a real piece of business between me and God. And now it's not just, I think I'll see what the new flavor of Bluebell ice cream tastes like. It's, am I willing to break this covenant agreement I've made with God where I've asked for help? And am I going to show up for my end of it? So that's where I find myself today, is making a new arrangement with God to please give me power and get me back into shape where if I do get to have a surgery, I'm in the best possible shape for it. And I'm in physical condition to be present for my family and my sponsees and that sort of thing. But it's important to know that throughout sobriety, things are going to come up that you find yourself powerless over, and that we have a solution in steps 6 and 7 of taking it to God and saying, you know, if you don't help me, I'm in real trouble here. It's a whole different thing. And but having said that, if I die on the plane on the way home, I'm way overpaid. You know, the deal I've had in the 37 years I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is unbelievable. Getting to be with Katie for 20 years, I've got children, I've got, you know, it'd be a sucky time to check out because everything's going great. I got a great marriage, we got hobbies, we got money, we got friends and AA and getting to do stuff like that. But it takes faith in God to a whole nother level. You know, where you, because this is something where you're like, this could really, the reality we're faced with requires either a steadfast faith in this power we talk about in these rooms, or I'm eaten up with fear when I'm going to sleep at night and waking up during the middle of the night. And I can't take months and months of that. So thank God for this process. Thank God for the power that we find in these rooms and for the support of people like you in rooms like these. I want to thank you so much for having me.